Okay, welcome back.
Thanks. Glad you're still there. So we have a guest who's been on before. His name is Owen Dell. He has a company called Owen Dell & Associates. He's a landscape architect. Welcome back to Radio Real Estate, Owen.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks for joining me.
Glad to be here. Happy Halloween.
What do you think of my outfit?
Oh, it's lovely. You're dressed as a realtor, aren't you?
Yes, yes. Note the sign, we'll sell your house for food. So there's a million different topics to fit into our segment here, but I understand that you are, and I have some passions that I want to talk to you about, my little hedge thing that I still haven't put in, and my buddy that actually put in a putting green, synthetic.
Uh-oh.
What do you think about, is that like...
You really want to know?
Sure.
Not all the products, but some of them are loaded with toxins, bacteria grow in them, they're not recyclable. They offer no landscape value in terms of carbon sequestration, cooling, and so forth. Not that I'm a big proponent of regular lawns, but synthetic lawns are probably one of the worst ideas. Sorry to your buddy, but
well,
one of the worst ideas in landscaping. Total pseudo-sustainable greenwashing.
Right, right. So other than the bacteria,
ask
toxins,
me what I really think.
You know, it's not a bad idea.
Yeah, other than that, yeah.
Well, he was phobic. He married this woman. He lives down in Redlands. He's been on the program as well. And he doesn't like lawns. He owns rental properties. There's no lawns. He owns zero, you know, low water usage.
That's good. Maintenance.
So he's a very good landscaper, you mm-hmm. know, the desert look. But he's a golfer, so he put in, and he had like a half acre. So he's got in the center a little bit, a little putting green. And what does it take to maintain real putting green grass?
Real, like bent, creeping bent is a tough deal. It's very, very hard to do. So, you know, there's no good answer to the question because conventional lawns are a terrible environmental burden and they take a lot of effort, cost a lot of money. If you're going to maintain putting green standards, and you have to have special mowers and special pest control and fertilizers, and it's a big, big pain. The synthetic is not so great. There's no good answer if you're going to have a putting green. Who knows which is the greater sin?
So I guess you're not a golfer.
I'm not a golfer either.
And then I guess right. If we talk about that on a scale in a backyard for a putting green, that would be just maybe 100 square feet.
Yeah.
And then if you transpose that into or translate that into hundreds of acres of golf courses.
Yeah.
A lot of water, maintenance, pesticides.
Huge environmental impacts. Absolutely huge. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And of course, the turf
Maybe
industry.
Maybe you should go on the golf show. Don't we have a golf show on this
station? Oh, that would be great. Yeah. When I'm in the mood to get lynched, I'll do that.
Well, I'll let Jeff know. I'll let him know and see.
Don't give him my address.
See ya. So, what... Well, since you started, since we're going down that road about impact on the environment and what is your philosophy and what do you like to present to people as a landscape architect and what's your vision?
Well, I've been doing what is now called sustainable landscaping for 40 years, and it's everywhere now. And I get Google alerts on sustainable landscaping, and I get 20 or 30 of them every day. The idea that a landscape has minimal negative impacts on the environment, water, pesticides, herbicides, fossil fuels, noise, air pollution, and so forth, which most conventional landscapes do. And then the other part that I'm really getting more and more interested in is the flip side of that thing, not just being less bad and having less negative impacts, but what does the landscape do? What does it actually do? Because we never ask that question. And we have all these ornamental plants around, and they're beautiful, and that's my job, to create beauty. But I think we have to ask some deeper questions these days about food production, native habitat, and so forth, so that the landscape actually has some function built into it.
Maybe plants that attract hummingbirds or certain types of birds or animal life that
Or beneficial insects that bring the pest population under control.
Ladybugs.
Ladybugs,
are there plants that attract ladybugs?
Yeah, sure. There's a whole list. The city of Santa Barbara has a list of plants that attract beneficial insects, yarrow and all sorts of things. And so you bring the ecosystem, if you will, into balance by planting appropriate things. Native plants, obviously, are adapted to our climate and our soils and don't need much care. And then food. more and more people are producing food in their landscapes, and it's such a great idea because it's right outside your door. It's not shipped in from 1,500 miles away or 3,000 miles away. It's probably going to be organic if you grew it yourself. It's certainly going to be fresh, and you can create what are called edible landscapes, which is basically using food-bearing plants as well as fiber plants and herbal plants and medicinal plants in ways that are basically well designed so that it doesn't look like a farm. It looks like a beautiful landscape.
Talking with Owen Dell, he's a landscape architect, 40 years looking at sustainable landscaping. And there's a ton of questions I have as we're just opening this up. I didn't write any questions down in advance, but it's just flowing
we'll make
nicely.
It up as we go.
And we will be able to take some calls, 452-2428, 452-2428, if you have a question for Owen Dell. And we'll give you his phone number and website afterwards if you want to get a hold of him. Food. I have a neighbor who has, on one side of me, has avocado tree that comes over the fence. So I get to share that. And on the back, the guy has an orange tree, and he doesn't eat oranges. And so they are the best oranges. And I'll get bags of them sometimes, or I can just use my... You know, he lets me use my picker. And so I'd like to, I have a, in my front yard, I have an area adjacent to my driveway. As you drive up to my house, parallel to the driveway, there's a strip of land that's maybe, you know, 25 feet long by maybe, you know, 7 feet wide. And I was thinking about plunking two or three trees there. And I was thinking a combination lemon-lime, because I love lemon and lime. Maybe you get it one on one tree. What do you think of
right,
that idea?
Right, grafted, where you can graft on different ones.
Should I get two miniatures, or should I get the grafted one, or does it matter?
Either one works fine. And that's enough space. You could probably get four trees in there. Semi-dwarf trees would be more than adequate for a family orchard. You know, we're trying to pack more and more edibles into landscapes now. And, of course, something like citrus is beautiful. Avocados are beautiful. Pineapple guavas are beautiful. There are so many things that are really easy to grow here. We have a 365-day growing season. Most of the places that we live are on excellent agricultural soils, particularly we're down in the flats in Santa Barbara or Goleta. Why aren't we growing food? I mean, it's just a waste. Going back to the lawn issue, there are 31 million gallons of water, a day put on, there are 31 million acres of lawn in the United States, which is larger than the entire area of the 100 largest U.S. cities. It's an incredible statistic. And the resources that go into that would grow 81 million acres of food.
Wow.
So 31 million acres of lawn, 81 million acres of food. It tells you which one is most efficient. And by growing food locally and sharing it with your neighbors, which is another whole aspect of edible landscaping, is actually getting together with your neighbors, as you're doing. Your neighbor doesn't eat oranges. At least he's sharing them. There are ways to share with the larger community, backyard harvest, food bank that pick up things, distribute to those who need it. All kinds of aspects to this that are really great.
Well,
why isn't everyone doing
what's
it?
What's interesting is the strip of land that I described on my side of the driveway, they have an equal amount on their side, another say 25 feet. So maybe we should plant the trees right, like kind of on the property line, you know, alternate, and maybe get full trees. I mean, what about this dwarf versus full trees? Describe the...
A dwarf, not all fruit trees are available in dwarf, but things like citrus are what they call a true genetic dwarf, which means it is not going to get bigger than 6 feet, maybe 7 feet. Produces a lot of fruit. I've got I've got a dwarf tangerine, and it produces probably... 200 to 300 fruits every year.
Wow.
That's a lot of fruit. Now, if you get a semi-dwarf, it's basically a full-size tree on a dwarfing rootstock, and it'll get up maybe 10 or 12 feet, which is really more than adequate. A full-size tree is more for an orchard, and they'll get, you know, 20 or more, and you really don't need that in a residential situation.
So that's really important to know. That's really good to know.
Absolutely.
I think another neighbor of mine, two doors over, has a Meyer lemon.
Great,
Meyer
lemon.
And they have it growing up against their house, and it almost looks like it's growing like a hedge or a branch. They just have it cut that way.
Yeah, it's called an espalier, and it's flat.
Yeah.
It soaks up more sun, produces a lot of fruit, as you probably have observed. Anyone can do this. You know, it's so easy to grow food here. We don't have to struggle with it like people do in colder climates. And it's just a slam dunk.
Something here. Say the
espalier. It's E-S-P-A-L-I-E-R. And it's basically a pruning technique where you take something and create almost like a two-dimensional flat plane with that plant. You have to keep pruning it.
Okay, and so it's not something that you buy that way. You can take a semi-dwarf and make it that way?
You can do that, or you can actually buy them and then maintain them that way. And it's a nice approach in a small space. If you've got, say, a 2 or 3 foot wide planter space next to a path or driveway, if it's on a south face where it gets a lot of sun, that espalier will just sit there and sunbathe, soak up the sun, and create fruit like crazy.
Right,
so
right.
It's a great way to go.
Well, you know what? I think you've definitely hit it on the head for me. The semi-dwarf is really the max I should get, and maybe even the dwarf citrus. I mean, I live alone. I mean, how much fruit do you need?
Exactly, exactly.
So I was thinking, I love lemons, mm-hmm. and I love limes. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I would, and I love oranges. And I'm thinking, should I get, are there two orange types that I could get that might give me oranges year-round, like one would...
There's a lot of different kinds of oranges. The navel orange, Washington navel, is the classic variety, and that produces the eating orange with the little belly button on it in the wintertime. And then there's the Valencia orange, which is the juice orange. It's a little smaller, it doesn't have the navel, and it's mainly for juicing, although you can certainly eat them. They're both delicious. If you have one of each, you get oranges pretty much year-round here. So, and you'll get a lot. I mean, and of course, the other thing is, if you don't have a family to eat it all up, share with your neighbors. There's a thing in town here called Santa Barbara Food Not Lawns, which I actually started the parent group of that quite a few years ago now, where neighbors get together and they share their produce. They get set up in somebody's driveway once a month and hang out and bring their stuff, whatever it is, kale or tomatoes or zucchinis or oranges, and share it all, and somebody bakes cookies, and they have a great time, and it's very cool. So if people are interested in that, it's Santa Barbara Food Not Lawns. I think it's sbfoodnotlawns.org is the website. And, you know, you can take your excess, and instead of letting it rot on the ground, you can actually spread it around.
You're listening to Owen Dell and Associates, Landscape Architecture, and his phone number after the program is 962-3253. And he has a website that would be what?
Owendell.com. It's hard to forget that.
Owendell.com, 962-3253. Yeah, it's a shame when I go to open houses sometimes and I see fruit, that, you know, just so much fruit. And like the neighbor, I mean, they just let it rot. It just sits on the ground, and it's food, and it's delicious, and it's
the best
organic,
food in the world,
and it's the best tasting food, and it's just like a crime. There's so many people,
One of my very first jobs when I was just a pup in this business, and I got some gardening maintenance jobs, and I had a little old lady up in Samarkand, and she had a beautiful orange tree in her backyard, loaded with oranges, and my first day on the job, I was 20 years old, and picked some of these oranges that were falling off, and I went and knocked on her back door, and I said, "No, here's your oranges." And she recoiled in horror. And I said, "What's the matter?" She said, "I don't eat those. I buy my oranges at the grocery store." And I peeled one open and I ate it in front of her, and I thought she was going to pass out. She was so shocked by this. And it would amaze me then. And I think, well, what's wrong with people?
Did she not realize that the ones she buy in the store also come off trees? Maybe she.
And trees that were sprayed and, you know, treated really badly. And I mean, you know, but that's the attitude that people have. The flip side of that is that now food growing is so popular, fruit tree growers can't keep stock. Seed companies are running out of seed every year for vegetable seeds. It's like a revolution that's
so
happening.
People are taking, following you, the Pied Piper of Johnny
Appleseed. Well, not following me, but you don't want to follow me too far. But no, seriously,
eating
this
a lot
is
of
a
fruit.
Nationwide, a nationwide transformation of what gardening is, what a landscape is, what the land around your house is and what it does. What's it for?
Well, I like the idea of not just planting, you know, what's not bad, but what's good, something that you can, you know, reap and enjoy. And if it's not fruit, it could be, like you said, the plants that attract attract beneficial insects that keep other bad insects away. And I want you to know, you'd be proud of me, I have a shed in my backyard that is held up by 6-inch metal I-beams sitting on the ground. And there are little vent holes, little rectangle mm-hmm. vent
right.
holes, you know, 2 or 3 per side.
Right.
Well, last year, I noticed that these yellow jacks, I guess, I don't know, what do you call bees that have the little, I don't know if they're actually yellow, but they have this little back to them. They're not wasps. They
yeah,
look like bees.
They're kind of two-part looking
yeah,
things.
Yeah, this little
they're aggressive.
Baggage thing on their back.
Uh-huh. You know?
And I noticed them going, I mean, hundreds in and out, in and out. Like, oh, man. And it was off to the side, in the back. And I was, you know, I was afraid to rile them up when I was going in and out of the door. But I just kind of stayed away. And I ended up buying a bag of poison where you fill it with water. It's like a nectar. It attracts them. And then I bought this spray. It says you can spray the queen and the nest and kill them all. And I never used it. I always kind of felt bad about it. So now this year, they came back, and this year they're on the front side, although now I think they're kind of going away. And it was worse, and it was right in the worst spot. But I just didn't have my heart to kill them all. And so my idea now is, in the winter, I want to get some screen mesh and just mesh it in, and then hopefully they'll
right.
probably come in my window in my house. And
right.
just give me to, you know, you want to keep them away. So I'm trying to do my part to be green and sustainable and not kill them. But, of course, you need bees.
Well, if they're honeybees, we really need pollinators. If we don't have bees, and of course bees are threatened by colony collapse disorder and other things, if we lose the bees, we lose ourselves because they pollinate the vast majority of our crops, other than grains.
Well, how would I know if these bees are honeybees?
You want to call Paul Cronshaw, who's the bee whisperer here in town, and he's an amazing guy, and he rescues wild beehives. He did one in my house.
Oh.
We pulled a wall apart where the feral honeybees had moved in.
Wow.
I got about 50 pints of honey out of the deal and gave it all away to my friends and still have a bunch left. And the bees were saved and actually moved to a better location.
Do you know someone in the real estate community here was actually looking for somebody who had land that would be willing to house these bees and said that this is a big value, that you will get, you know, they're good for your yard and you'll get honey and, you know, because people at first are a little scared of bees.
Yeah.
But these bees, you know what? I thought about that. I thought, you know, they're probably doing something for the nature and the plants, and I just couldn't kill them. And they never bothered me. You know, and I'd mow the lawn, even that loud mower. I was see too many killer bee movies. I was waiting for
right.
them to, like,
well,
swarm
we all got,
around me.
We all got scared about the killer bees.
Yeah, yeah. What happened with those?
They bred with more gentle bees as they came north from Brazil, and by the time they got here, there is killer bee gene, our killer bee genes in our bees now.
Yes.
And they're more aggressive than honeybees were, you know, 20 years ago.
Yes.
But it hasn't been that big of a deal. So
that's funny.
It was diluted, I guess you could say, their aggressiveness by the intermingling.
Well, I'm glad they lost then. I was talking about marriage in the first segment, so you're talking about marrying the killer bees with the probably a lot of couples that we could illustrate. One is the killer bee. So, you know, I was going to ask you about hedges. And so now when you started talking about this, let's see how good I am. Espalier. Espalier. Oh, it sounds French.
It's probably French. Yes.
Espalier. So instead of a hedge, what kind of plant that might be more beneficial than a hedge? I don't know if you can get a fruit tree to grow dense enough to be like a hedge.
Well, citrus, once again, makes a nice hedge. It's evergreen. With a hedge, of course, you want evergreen, and so you don't want things losing their leaves because
right.
then you've lost the value of the hedge or a
right.
great deal of it. Something that's edible and useful is the pineapple guava or feijoa, which is a really nice adapted shrub for here. It's very attractive. And it makes hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pineapple guavas every fall. I've just finished harvesting mine, and they're very tasty. And it's almost a no-maintenance plant.
And you could make it thick enough? Grow thick enough so
yeah.
it would be a hedge-like?
It's commonly used as a hedge. And you could also go in the direction of natives with something like toyon or ceanothus or barberry or lemonade berry. Those are all really good native hedge plants. They don't produce food for us, but they're native plants. There's a lot of better ways to go than the typical Pittosporum or Eugenia hedge, which have a lot of problems. They get much too big. They're really trees, and we're constantly trying to trim to keep the size down.
Right, right. Santa Barbara hedge is the Eugenia.
Eugenia.
Which
got hit by the psyllid.
Right.
But in any case, it's a 100-foot tall tree, and we try to keep
the original,
it as a 6-foot tall
shrub. What
about
the privets?
Privets are also really more of a large shrub. They're not really a tree. It's a little bit more adapted than the big Pittosporum Eugenia approach.
And they grow slow and maybe?
And they grow relatively slowly.
Okay.
The thing about hedges is one of the things is cost. And I calculated recently that if you have one plant, and this isn't just hedges, but any plant that's growing too big for its space, which, you know, you drive around town and you see all these sheared plants. They're boxes and cubes and spheres and ovals and fanciful shapes. And the gardeners just seem to think that everything that lives has to be sheared into a geometric
a box,
shape.
Yeah, or, yeah.
So if you spend, your gardener spends 15 minutes managing the size of one plant and cleaning up at, say, $35 an hour. You're looking at about $10 per service, if you will. If you do that 10 times a year, because we have a year-round growing season here, that's $100 a year for that plant just to keep it in bounds and keep it sheared and not even looking that good. 10 years, that's $1,000. 20 years, that's $2,000. That's one plant. Suppose you have 10 of them. Suppose you have 100 of them on your property. You don't realize that you're spending an enormous amount of money managing something simply because it didn't have the space to grow naturally.
Now we know why my friend put in the putting green, synthetic putting green. We
got to take a break.
We got to take a break. I was going to actually say goodbye to you, but stay over. I got another segment. I got to do some real estate stuff, but stay over because I did want you to mention about your what you're offering home buyers. Owen Dell, landscape architect, 962-3253, owendell.com. You're listening to Mark Schneidman's Radio Real Estate. Stay tuned. You'll be right back.